So we can begin, and as usual, be comfortable, and we'll see how it goes. If you have any questions about parts of the talk that aren't clear for you, then obviously feel invited to ask a question or inquire. Some of it might be quite easy to follow. There is potential that some of it might be a little confusing. Hopefully not confused, but we'll see about that. So, I want to speak today about kind of two aspects of meditation practice. One is the cultivation of calmness, and the other is cultivating the quality of investigation into experience. So hopefully, and you know, I understand very hopefully, we may have had a moment or two of feeling of calm in the time here. You know, where the breath has really kind of been able to bring the body and the mind together into some kind of union, like feeling breath and body coming together, mind and body rather coming together through breath. You know, a time where maybe the thoughts aren't so demanding, aren't so needing of our attention, and they can kind of just drift and be held in this kind of broader awareness we've been referring to. Or our emotional life is quite calm. And so in those moments, it's something very, very nice. But it's really well worth noticing that that's also what we refer to as a conditioned moment, right? It's a gift from the retreat. And it's a gift from, you know, the circumstance of how this kind of event is put together. So if you've really enjoyed it, lovely. But not to anticipate that this is the new me going forward. You know, it is also a conditioned thing. It's what we come on retreat for much, and it offers opportunities. You know, we've been really wise while being here. You know, many of us have kind of turned our phones off, turned off taking in new information, which is something we do a lot of the time. The food here has been really a healthy diet. You know, we've been able to eat wisely, not too sweet, not too salty, just good for the body, and relax into that. And the focus for our time here has been primarily the Dharma, the way things are, looking at life, looking at the process of life, having that opportunity to investigate. And we've been, you know, engaging in wise actions, these kind of meditative movements, the gentle stretches, times where we've given service, acted for the benefit of everyone. You know, all of these things come together, the meditation, the sharing the wisdom in the small groups, you know, all of it adds to the quality of calmness. You know, the stillness of our body in the sitting, stillness of the mind, hopefully, in the movement, in the walking meditation or times of service and support. And so, you know, this is a really lovely quality, but it's not actually the goal of meditation. The goal of meditation isn't just to cultivate calmness. It's not the end in itself. And it can actually be a time for changing the focus a little bit, applying the energy a little bit, looking into life. So we're actually developing this calmness, right? It's not just a station on the way of the journey, you know, it's really invaluable place to stay in, rest in, recognize it's possible to cultivate calmness. But it's also so that we can get to know the underlying patterns, right? The underlying nature of how we come into being. So meditation becomes, in some levels, a certain dance between this calmness and insight, inquiry, between a steadiness, like the clearing of the lake, you know, on those clear days where the stuff can really settle down, but also sometimes, you know, stirring up the bottom a little bit to check what's actually going on in this lake. So that kind of balance between the two, where we're not interfering too much, but we're also not just kind of, oh, but it's perfect now, I don't want to go near it, don't want to bring life into contact with calmness. It's too good an experience. So it's also a balancing between acceptance of what we find and also interest in what we find. And I hope that we can kind of sense that these aren't two different things, but actually two parts that deepen and support each other. You know, the inquiry time actually can lead to a more established calmness, just as the calmness can actually lead to the conditions where we can more investigate life. And we can actually use the calmness to really get to know the process, really get to know how I work, what makes me tick, what ticks me off, as we say in English, you know, what annoys me, you know, and what thrills me in life, what draws me, what am I drawn away from, pulled away from. So one of the factors of calmness that comes from retreat, or comes from you know, retreat in kind of a broader sense, bringing ourselves to practice, is giving a bit more space in the temporal sense, in the time sense, right? We can actually see the process sometimes a little bit slower, start to see, I can feel myself changing. You know, we have a deeper sensitivity to those changes. And that's really, really useful, because we're actually, in terms of a person, so as a person, if we imagine ourselves as actually a piece of music, you know, we're actually one of those quite complex pieces of music, quite an orchestral coming together as a piece of music. We're not just some simple little tune that you can pick up when, you know, you've never seen this instrument before and anyone can play this simple do-do-do-do-do kind of tune. It's really complex. It's quite a thing to undertake. And those of us who kind of have tried to learn pieces of music can really understand that it's what's something really helpful when you're playing something that is beyond your limit is to actually play it a lot slower than you would if you were performing it or offering it to other people's ears. So really going slow into your process. So something that calmness offers. And that way, you know, we can actually learn to play something well. In one of my music teachers suggests, you know, that if you're actually trying to play that finished thing and then you get there and you kind of blur a few notes and you get, you know, it's good enough, but it's the right speed, it kind of sounds like the thing. What you're actually training yourself to do is you're just practicing how to make that mistake over and over again. You know, you're actually using your practice session to learn how to make mistakes. Like, so much better to actually do something slower, less impressive perhaps, even to yourself, but actually more honest, more real. So that's something that meditation, life, and music kind of all share in common. There's not an interest in rushing, right? There's not an interest in the goal, the result, but there's real interest in the path. Real interest in actually what's underlying this moment, right? What's actually happening here. And, you know, what's leading to these habits of our mind, habits of feeling, habits of action. And, you know, there are many, many examples we could use, but one that kind of was striking me as I was thinking about this was when we do this Being Peace retreat that Zar spoke about, we're kind of opening ourselves up into a very painful situation. So this has parallels with meditation, as it does in many situations in life. And what I've noticed many times is that I open to the painful complexity of the situation. It's not the first impulse of just like, oh, this is painful, I have to make space for this pain. It's actually, whose fault is this? Is kind of the thought that comes into my mind. Who's actually to blame for this? And once I'm kind of, the thinking almost seems to be, once I found out who's to blame, then I can be really clear about it and, I don't know what, protest, write them a letter, make them stop. And so what's actually underlying that, looking for the one to blame? And what's kind of underlying that I've come to see is actually that feeling of like, I can't take this much pain. I can't actually take this much injustice. And that's somewhat of just an idea of what I can take, what I can't take. Like, because I haven't actually tried it, right? I'm out there looking for the one to blame, looking for the fix. Have I actually really tried? Like, what do we actually know the capacity of our heart to open to pain? And so if I come with that additional antagonistic attitude towards a situation of pain and injustice, I'm kind of adding on top of it, you know, kind of participating in the very thing I don't want, right? This is something that kind of appears in pop psychology quite a lot, you know. Oh, you don't like something about someone? It's probably something about yourself that you don't like in them. But like, yeah, I don't like something, but I'm actually participating in it, right? There's actually there's a certain aggression that I'm feeling towards seeing aggression. It's a certain way of relating in a protective way that perhaps has actually led to this situation. So we really don't need people coming in to a situation like this with more blame, you know, with more hatred, with more separation. Right? There's really enough tension, there's really enough low-level thinking in a situation like that, lazy thinking. And so we call this retreat Being Peace because we actually want to bring peace into that situation, right? We want to actually bring that opportunity for people to change in their own speed by being a mirror of something possible in that circumstance, not just being another participant. So, you know, it came very true to me that I actually have to find a way of really finding out if I have the capacity for this sadness under the frustration to kind of come up and be felt and be let to be present. And that's really where kind of the calmness and the other qualities really can allow for that insight to come through, right? Gives that optionality to life. And yeah, of course, it is possible to experience that much sadness. It is possible to experience that much pain. The heart is rightly called boundless. You know, it really will stretch and expand in ways that the mind doesn't ever perhaps get used to believing that it can. So this Being Peace retreat is an opportunity for seeing how the inner and the outer kind of reflect each other. And we call it a retreat because let's say that oftentimes retreat means moving back, moving away from. And our retreats, almost all of them, the Sanghasava retreats that we organize, are meditation in action, you know, but we still call them retreats. And I sometimes like to contemplate, like, well, is that the right name? Do we need to find another name? But the actual thing that I think is the retreat is actually like a retreating in, a coming into the center, a really coming in, looking within to how I'm responding in the world. And so in that way, life can be a retreat, right? Even though it's really engaged, a life that's really engaged is actually be a retreat if we come from that attitude. I don't know what these things are called, where you have like a glass ball and it has like a bluish electricity inside and it kind of like little things shoot out of the thing. I never found out what that was called. But kind of like, we live like that, right? We're looking outward for someone to say, yeah, you're okay. You know, we look outwards for affirmation of our good qualities. And retreat is kind of drawing in, concentrating, being with the center. You know, that's what concentration means, to come with the center. And really tuning in, and from there, getting to know the experience, and then acting from there, is really radically different than this. You know, seeking out things. You know, satisfaction, meaning, purpose. But actually coming deep down within. So I want to speak about something for the second part of this talk, which is to do with Have you heard of this acronym? Acronym is where you use like a number of letters to put together a word. So this is the four-letter word RAIN, used in meditation practice. Some of you will have. So I don't know if you can do it in Finnish. You can try. Someone once did it in French, I think. I can't remember. So RAIN, R-A-I-N. So the R is for recognize, like recognize the experience you're having. So this is a path of transformation. This is a path of inquiry. And it's quite easy to remember, so it's useful to share it with people. R is to recognize like what's happening, realize what's happening. A is to accept what is happening, right? We don't get anywhere without accepting the reality. Even if we don't like it, it's not the path to involvement with life. Putting a, you know, like the ostrich with its head in the sand, whatever. So we recognize and we accept or allow. And the next is we investigate or inquire into like what it is. Okay, so we're kind of shifting. The first two are quite passive, like, okay, this is what it is. The next one's a little bit investigating, involved, like looking at it. Well, what is this? Where is this coming from? Why am I feeling this way? And then the last step is the non-identification with what is happening. Okay, so that first experience is, you know, that I'm blaming people, right, in this example. I'm looking for the blame person. And at the end, we realize, this was all part of this pattern. It was underlying. I couldn't see the sadness. I couldn't be with the sadness. So we realized that blame rose out of that, covering over not being with the sadness. It's not who I am, right? It's just how I was acting in that moment. So I think we kind of have a sense of the recognize and the accept. So we kind of, in that accepting and allowing, we're choosing to kind of divert ourselves away from the, from either seeking distraction or you know, not wanting to meet it through, we might just try and run away from the experience through distraction, or we might just try and, what's it called, when you're kind of too spiritually good for something, when you, like, this isn't actually affecting me, you know, that kind of denial type of approach. When it probably is, you know, and you do actually have to spend some time and have a look at it. So it's kind of an invitation to sometimes be that very thing we really don't want to be. I don't want to be that blaming guy. I don't want to be that fearful person. I don't want to be not up to it, you know, whatever that is for ourselves. So it's really allowing ourselves to also fail, to also not live up to our own expectations. Because eventually we're kind of growing into a space that doesn't need to worry too much about the content. Okay, this is the truth of this. So we can really allow for things because it may not be eventually who we really are. But we don't kind of go in with it playing that game. We're kind of going into that accepting what is there, listening to what is there. Just like someone who comes into your home has a story to tell. You want to allow them to tell it. So in this sense, we're kind of widening the lens. Also, we're widening the lens of what's happening. And we're opening up to all of the manifestation. So we might end up seeing more than we expected. And it also means that we're kind of holding this in a larger container. This is one of the truths of the teaching, is that how we hold things really changes how they behave. So we're actually allowing things to manifest as they are. And Zohar mentioned before, this warrior spirit, you know, that we kind of need to meet this. It does take, you know, a presence, a courageousness to be there and admit where we're at. And this warrior spirit really reminds me of some kind of non-violent activists I've met, particularly in Palestine, where it's where I meet most of these kind of people. It's like, wow, that kind of courageousness to be vulnerable, but really be present. And how they also have to accept the situation that they're in, right? You can't just rage against the situation that you're in. And the truth that they've kind of explained to other people and to me is how that their way is actually more powerful than violence. Right? This is something until you really get to listen to these people and hear it in their own authentic voice, it's almost difficult to kind of understand how is non-violence more powerful than violence. And one of them, called Abu Ali Awad, described it as, he said, maybe misquoting him, perhaps shouldn't have mentioned him by name, but he's a great wise being, really lovely person, and he said, you know, that it's more powerful because you're not being who they want you to be, right? When you participate in violence, you become who they want you to be, right? Non-violence is being who you want to be. It's being who you value, right? If you get involved in this exchange of violence, you're becoming weaker because you're playing a part that they actually want you to play. It's very, very powerful. You know, power and force will tire. This is what we know. Power and force will tire, right? It's taking effort. But truth, being your truth, will endure. Because you can keep on doing that. You know how to do that. That's what you know how to do. It's something we can bring into our meditation as well, right? Conforming isn't necessary. There's an inner truth, an inner power that we can utilize. Anger will tire. Love will endure. So if we can kind of trust in this way of being, we can open and accept. We're creating the environment to begin on the other side of the rain. Right? We have the recognize, accept, and then we move into the investigation and inquiry only once we've generated that larger container to hold the exploration. So knowing what is here as clearly as possible, allowing it to express itself, then gives us, you know, a good place to investigate and inquire into our state of mind, our state of being. And it's here we can start to kind of narrow the lens, right? So we widened the lens here. We can narrow the lens and really start to investigate and dive into what's this made up of? What's this feel like? What's this actually built upon? What's the nature of this experience? Find out what's going on. And one useful tool in this is getting to understand what in Buddhism is referred to as the chain of dependent origination. And this is quite a complex teaching and probably a complex translation. It's the chain of dependent origination. It's how things lead to another and build up and they link together like a chain, you know, like all these links in the chain. It's quite a complex map. Well, let's say it's quite a simple map for quite a complex process, right? So it's a simplification of what might happen, but it's an idea of how we can lead from ignorance to not seeing clearly, right? This ignorant state, right up to an experience of suffering, including identification, including reactivity, including the expectations and the aversions that kind of lead in through this chain. It's something that's really, really important to look at. But it's always rooted in an ignorance of Dharma, of the way things are, of things as they are. It's an ignorance of understanding the nature, and it's often an ignorance of understanding that things actually are dependently originated, right? That our experience actually is part of a chain of events, that a sequence of events of things are impacting on each other. So I have a only half made up example about myself, kind of feeling low and feeling undervalued. So just using that experience, like, and feeling that all these people looking at me don't really think I'm any good, which isn't happening right now because you're just really lovely, but it could easily be happening because it's just inside me, right? and how that leads to me feeling distance from you and then putting fences up and deciding whatever, not to give this talk or not to expose myself or not to get involved. So we can kind of understand that. That can be a truth for many of us. It's a truth for myself also at times. And I'm probably open to the possibility that some of this could be dependent on factors outside of my control, right? I really want you to like me, but I'm afraid that you don't like me for whatever reason. But I'm probably not including automatically, it's not a human thing to include, of how this is actually, this moment, this feeling, is actually quite a lot also dependent on how I'm viewing the situation and how I'm relating to the situation. And the Buddha initially had some reservations about delivering these kind of teachings because he thought it was too subtle for people to understand because it's not just the way that we go about it. But I don't think it is. I don't think it's too subtle. And you know, I don't know if it's even true if he really did think that. But he did carry on and offer these teachings. So the question at this moment is, could I actually see the parts of this moment in the light of the Dharma? Like what's happening? Can I bring the Dharma into this experience and actually find the liberation in this experience? So the initial thing that I can do is this kind of wider focus that we spoke about is, can I actually just recognize, allow and accept that I'm feeling bad? Right? In this moment, I'm just feeling bad. Before it goes any further, right? I'm just feeling bad. And actually get to know what this feels like. And this already would be a really radical transformation in what's going to happen. Right, we're kind of stepping out of the chain a little bit, not necessarily all the way, but you know, we can actually step out of the chain. But in this example, I'm not in the space to do that, so I'm believing the thoughts and feelings that are happening. Now, am I aware that I'm putting my happiness, right? My happiness is dependent on you liking me, right? Am I even aware that I've done that? I've traded that. Like, if you like me, I'll be happy. If you don't like me, I won't be happy. Right? There must have been some optionality in there. So we have this ignorance breeding the expectation. Right? I need this. I need your affirmation, but like whatever. That's not a very helpful word, perhaps. I need you to think well of me anyway, so that I can think well of myself. But there could be a shorter circuit. I could actually just look at my own well-being, look at my own good intentions. But it's not always easy to do that. Now, I probably won't even consider that you might not be actually thinking poorly of me. Right? I may not even get to doubt that. Because I'm feeling low in confidence and I perceive some signals that I'm not wanted or valued. You know, you don't want to catch my eye or you don't want to... You often disappear when I come around. So have I actually started believing the thoughts in my head as a reality? Right? This narrative has become more true than truth itself. And what would be a really sensible thing then to do would be to find that courage to check in with you. Like, you know, could we spend some time together, you know, or whatever, something simple. Take that courage to be vulnerable, because already you're imagining the worst. Like, I'm imagining the worst. Like, what could be worse than the worst? maybe some of us can always imagine something a little bit worse. So we can see how the ignorance and the imagination is actually shaping the body and mind experience, right? It's shaping the way we think, but it's also shaping the way we feel and the way we act, and we can... Like it's a shrinking in, it's a contraction, right? The thoughts are actually affecting the consciousness and they're actually affecting the perception, right? So we're actually our perception can also start to change, like what we see. So what appeared even like just kind of flat, not too bothered either way, starts to be, you know, the way we're looking is looking for those signs, looking for more signs that confirm what we're feeling. And usually with certain thoughts, certain feelings often come along, you know, with this contractedness of those feelings. And that feeling itself is unpleasant. That way of thinking is unpleasant. And this in the Dharma teachings is referred to as the Vedana of an experience. It's really important to notice if it's an unpleasant experience and we just know, ah, this is an unpleasant experience. Or if it's a pleasant experience, ah, this is just an this is just a pleasant experience. This is just a neutral experience. Because in that understanding, we notice that, say in this example, having the unpleasant experience, it's going to be met with this kind of drawing away, with this aversion. And that also leads to a more contracted sense of self. And that contracted sense of self is also unpleasant. And that unpleasantness leads to a further contraction. And it just kind of goes on and on. But any moment we can understand, oh, this is a contracted sense of self. I expect I'm kind of shrinking away at this moment. We're already observing ourselves in a different way. So we have this body experience and then we have aversion to the body experience. It doesn't actually help it go away. It can just kind of makes it worse, adds more fuel onto this fire, which is leading me into a state of quite unhappiness. And also because of the way it's going, it's actually kind of confirming that, yeah, I am actually kind of quite hopeless. And why was I even thinking that somebody could ever like me? You know, it really put me into a box. I've made this self-fulfilling prophecy, you know, I've generated the truth of what I was believing in just by the misfortune of not seeing that there was avidya, ignorance, at the root of all of this. And of course, this is just one mirror, and it also leads in a different direction if it leads to the wanting type of craving, to something pleasant. We can see it, it'll play out in a similar way towards that. But unfortunately, whichever way it leads, it actually leads us into a place where it's very, very difficult to choose wisely, you know, to act wisely. Like our true potential is this kind of feeling at ease with life, and then we make wiser decisions, and you know, more bounteous and more beneficial things come. We can be more generous, and then we know that from generosity leads to less self, and from less self leads to more generosity, more enjoyment of life. But in this state, we're feeling really, really contracted, really strong self-view. And if we do choose an action from here, right, it choose what we become from here, what we are, it's often going to be one of those habitual but not that healthy kind of choices. So in my example, I would probably make my excuses slip away, or maybe not even say anything, just find an opportunity when I can be invisible and just get out of that situation, not challenge it at all. For other of us, we would just feel very annoyed. We might shout, we might dislike someone, hate them, or say something unpleasant, just as a way of kind of changing it. But whatever that habit energy leads to, what we can see is it's actually fulfilling a pattern in our life, right? And this seeing this dependent origination is hopefully a way of breaking out of the patterns of our habitual actions. Like, we don't have to take birth, right? We're actually reborn in this moment as someone, right? We have that opportunity. We're gonna make an action, become someone who does some kind of action. And in that moment, we've taken birth as a someone, as a something. And that's starting to fill out this length of the dependent origination. From that ignorance, we've kind of become someone we don't deep down want to be. And deep down, that means this person is not going to sustain, this person is going to, there's going to be cracks in how this person is. It's not someone we truly believe ourselves to be. You know, we're playing a persona. The persona is the mask that they used to wear on the stage. Persona means to sound through. So you'd put this mask on that had the big mouthpiece, and that's where mask, persona is a mask, it's a person we play. And eventually this mask cracks because it's not truly who we are. It falls apart. And in that, there can be some pain and disappointment of realizing that we haven't been our true self in that moment. We haven't being all we could be. And what's really important is that this is another time where that whole chain can start getting into place again. If we blame ourselves, oh, you know, there you were not being your true self. You're never going to be your true self. It's typical of you, you know, whatever you do. And this is something we can also see playing out in the meditations, you know. Our mind wanders and then suddenly, pop, oh, we're back. And, you know, what do we do with that moment? And what we do with that moment is a real moment of the training, right? That moment is a moment of being present. It's a moment of being here. It's a moment of opportunity. And can we just come back, whatever it is that's the practice of that time, into the breath, into the body, into the direct experience? Or do we actually squander that beautiful present and think, oh, you're hopeless. You're lost all the time. Typical. I don't think you've been present hardly at all. I don't know why you bother. Like, you're no good at this. Look at the person in front of you. They're like a rock, you know, or any other kind of narrative. We just throw it away. This beautiful opportunity, right? Is it too much just to appreciate, oh, I'm back. It's now. Wow, so much I can do with this moment. So if we can develop the skill to see this dependent chain arising in our lives again and again, it really helps us to understand how life unfolds. It's just a map, you know, and it's not a single chain, and it'll interact in different ways. But it's another one of those teachings that really goes deep, really is interesting to look into, and does allow us to increase the capacity of choice in what's going on. Right, we can kind of feel like we're just whirling down like an escalator or a water slide or whatever. It's just got its own course. It always goes this way. It always goes this way. But actually, there are many other exit routes. There are many other opportunities in there. And once we get to know what they are in this chain of dependent origination, we actually have many more options of like, oh, this slide goes off over there. Who would have thought? And that's actually quite enjoyable and leads to friendship and leads to connection and leads to beneficial actions and feeling good. So here's some tips of other routes on the way that we can pay attention to how we're paying attention, right? See how our perceptions and reactions are actually in this situation. So pay attention to how you're paying attention, seeing how that affects your life. We can pay attention to the feeling tone of an experience, right? That just that bare thing. Is this actually an unpleasant experience? Am I having an unpleasant experience? And if I am, watch out that I'm going to lead, that might lead to some aversion, right? Just being aware of that. Oh, you know, just being aware of that. And if I'm having some kind of pleasant experience, enjoying the pleasant experience, like there's not enough pleasant experiences in life, but am I clinging on to this? Am I going to make this last forever? You know, or can I just enjoy it? You know, like William Blake saying, kiss the joy as it flies, right? Not catch the fly and put it in a jar and keep it forever. My fly! So like, it's enjoying the life, but also not trapping it, right? And if it's a neutral experience, being aware, this might lead to boredom, right? Like however many minutes of talk we've had, it could lead to boredom. Be aware. So like, bring in the energy. Like Zara was speaking about, bring in the enthusiasm, like, how can we get more interested in this apparently boring situation, right? No moment in life is boring. No moment in life is a repeat, right? So just watch out for that thinking. So, oh, nothing's happening. Wow. So much is happening. Yeah.
Is it like, I thought it's quite a good thing, like you are not feeling bad, not feeling good, but it's like quite present and neutral feeling.
Yeah, so if you're present, 100% top marks, fantastic, yeah? What normally leads is we kind of neutral, and it's like,
Okay, it's like yeah. Minus neutral.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, like, don't worry, it's just neutral. Kind of that's what the mind will say, you know, because it's not a threat and it's not something I can get. Mm-hmm. So it's just the rest of stuff kind of thing. But if we actually can explore the neutral, like you're saying, and be present with it, what we can uncover is that, wow, there's like a whole, you know, I don't know what percentage of the life is this neutral, like just seeing How could seeing anything be neutral? Just smelling? Like what a, you know, like life is such a wonderful thing. And we kind of, yeah, nothing special, you know, but mindfulness and presence really enlivens the experience. It's one of the beautiful gifts of meditation. It adds joy to a lot more aspects of our life. And yeah, thanks for drawing that out. We can also try and open up the heart, mind, body space, you know, just physically open it up if we're starting to feel contracted, right? Just kind of use the yoga of the body to like open the space. We can practice metta, you know, when we're feeling contracted or separate. Like it's, and in that way, we actually offer it to another person. We're seeing the similarity. We're recognizing, yeah, I want to be happy. You want to be happy. Maybe in this moment, we're not making each other happy, but we both wish for that. We're both sharing this. You know, it's something we share. It's something that connects us. And the additional thing is we can just bring a friendly, very, very friendly sense of doubt about whatever's happening. Like this is just a story playing out, right? I'm just performing a part, being this persona, right? That doubt can also just allow, what can I remember from the dependent origination? And you have to kind of check it out for yourself because I didn't want to bore you with another list. But like there are people in Naroda, I know, the sitting groups, their facilitators are really keen on it. And you know, there's many online opportunities and books written about this. It's not a hidden teaching, so it's really something we can explore.
What was the name, or how can I find it?
Dependent origination?
You meant that.
Yeah, that one, yeah. Or, you know, just check in with your local Naroda facilitator. I've heard, you know, the Naroda facilitators that I know are quite keen on it. But you know, ultimately, the more times we actually see this experience and the more times that we look at how experience unfolds in the light of anything, you know, any practice that we do, we get better at it, right? Whatever you practice doing, you become better at it. This is another one of my music teacher's quotes. You know, so just make sure that whatever you're doing is something you want to get good at doing. That was his kind of bottom line, which, you know, If what we end up doing is like having an aspiration to be a generous person, but what we end up practicing is how to be the greedy person who eats the last bit of cake and hides in a corner so that no one sees the icing on their face, you know, then that's what we'll become good at. That's the truth of life, right? Whatever your aspiration, make sure you do it. Make sure you do it step by step. And so as we get to see that this is just an unfolding, right, this is just the chain of dependent origination. It's a truth that's been true for thousands of years. The Buddha didn't even invent it, I think. He adapted a system that was already existing. This is just the truth of how things evolve. This is not who you are. And that's what finally lands us on the N, the non-identification. Right, this is a process. This is an unfolding. And it has many, many escape routes from the helter-skelter, from the carousel, from the water slide, right? There are many, many options. And really be willing to explore it and see, like, does this bring more space into my life? Does this bring more freedom? And if it does, what's it bringing the space and the freedom for? And normally, if we create space and freedom, what wants to fill it in is love, is positive action in the world. So again, this isn't a selfish undertaking. It's something that brings energy that we can then utilize in the world, that we can be peace, you know, whatever it is that we feel is needed in the world. So really just seeing if we can be willing to, you know, let a little rain fall on our investigation of our experience. But whatever's happening at any time, recognizing, accepting, really accepting, right? Not just accepting so I can get on with investigating you. Really accepting it, right? Making sure we give plenty of time to that. Am I really wide? Am I really open? Am I really letting this in? And then investigating into it, like seeing, how did we get here? What's this built upon? Where's this leading to? And then eventually letting it go, letting it live its life. Right, so this isn't nihilism, right? It's not that nothing means anything. It's really the path of love, and it's really that as our intention and our energy as we go through it. It's really looking to be intimate. And I really believe that if we can find the courage to meet how we are and look into it all of life will actually be revealed. Right? The real whole mystery of life is revealed in even these simple little moments, even these simple little pleasant, unpleasant, neutral moments. The whole depth of life is here. The whole depth of experience is here. And there's no need to rush, but there's also no need to hesitate. You know, we can begin now, together. It was the great sage Milarepa suggested, and good luck with translating. Let's hasten slowly. Let's hasten slowly.
I think hasten is a really hard word.
So let's...
So it's like hurry up, not slowly.
Yeah, let's get on with it, but take our time. So let's have a few quiet minutes to close this session. May all beings have the wisdom to recognize what is happening, the heart to accept what they find, the courage to investigate their experience, and the ability to let go into non-self. So we have about 10 minutes to explore our pre-dinner experience, either silently in here or with conversation elsewhere. Thank you for your listening.